Welcome to The Art of Medicine, the program that explores the arts, business, and clinical aspects of the practice of medicine. I'm Dr. Andrew Wilner, and today I have a special guest, Rabbi Jeremy Simons. Welcome, Rabbi.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here, Doctor.
So I think the big question, first of all, is why a rabbi on the show? And so I'm gonna tell a story. Years ago, I remember I was making rounds at the hospital, which is what I do most of my professional life. And there was a patient who was very sick. She'd had a hip fracture and then total organ failure. And so there was a whole line of specialists. In fact, I had to wait in line to get into her room. The cardiology guy went in, and the kidney guy went in, and the lung guy went in, and the orthopedic guy went in. You know, we all took our turns with our own very specialized sort of view of this patient. Usually when the neurologist goes in, it's not so good. And she wasn't doing that great. So I went in and I stepped outside and I was chatting with the resident about the sort of, it was looking pretty grim in there. And the next thing I know, I see a hospital chaplain go in. And I thought, I don't know, it's kind of interesting. He's got his own little, you know, kit. And he's going to do his thing. And now I practice in a county hospital, about 300 beds, and we have hospital chaplains roaming around. And I, you know, they're always very smiley and pleasant and say hello. You know, not everybody says hello in the hallways, but the chaplains always say hi. But I never really know where I'm meeting them. You know, what is their mission? And so I thought I'd take advantage of you and your training to explain this to me. I mean, you're a rabbi, and I know part of the job of rabbis is to comfort the sick, right, and visit them in the hospital. And it's a long Jewish tradition, which I want you to educate me about. So first tell me a little bit about the training that's involved to get you where you are and how that prepares you to help the sick.
Sure. So our training, at least in rabbinical school, and at least in the school that I went to, has two main parts that prepares us for this kind of work. The first is the classroom or theoretical side, and that goes through classes that we take called practical rabbinics. People often ask, like, all right, rabbinical school is 5 years. What do you do for 5 years? Like, do you just study Torah? Like, you know, that's part of it. But there's this element called practical rabbinics, which means, like, all right, Rabbi, you're going to have to do a wedding or a funeral or a bar mitzvah or whatever it's going to be. This is how you actually do those things. Like, here are the steps to do it. So in that course, in that line of work, we also, or line of study, I should say, we also talk about hospital visits. When do you do them? Why do you do them? How do you go through it? That sort of thing. And I'll go into some of the specifics later if you want to know the answers to those questions. And then we also have a required course called pastoral care or pastoral counseling. And that's a year-long course all rabbinic students take where we talk about the role of rabbi as counselor. And for a lot of us going into rabbinical school, most people go in their mid to late 20s. That was my case, at least. And I'll be honest that it hadn't really occurred to me that rabbis do as much counseling work as they do. As a younger person who hadn't had any major medical issues, you know, I had never thought to seek out a rabbi for this kind of thing, but people often do. They go to their rabbis for mental health issues, for physical health issues, where they want guidance and spiritual care. So we have to be trained on how to be able to provide that. And if you're wondering, well, are rabbis actually competent and capable of doing that? The number one thing I remember from that class taught by a LCSW, a licensed clinical social worker, is you are not a therapist. That was like a mantra that was written on the board that we had to repeat back, that you are not a therapist. You are on the front lines. You can provide limited pastoral care, but you are not a mental health professional. And part of your job as a rabbi is recognizing that, not trying to be something you aren't, and making sure that people get to the professional care they need when it goes beyond what you are able to provide. it's a bit of a tangent, but I share that only because there is, unfortunately, a stigma around mental health care in our country and our society. And so oftentimes people will seek out a rabbi because it feels less stigmatic than going to a licensed therapist. So we often interact with people who then we can refer out and be that first step to getting them care.
I think that's true. I mean, many people are willing to, you know, confess their sins to a priest, but they would never consider going to a psychiatrist. Exactly. And, you know, and it's interesting, the sort of overlap here. You know, I'm a neurologist. We deal with the brain. But then there's also sort of the mind, right? We know that there's a brain-mind connection. And then to push it even further, most of us believe in a soul. And there's been a lot of neuroanatomical inquests to find out where is the soul. For example, in the brain, we know which part of the brain makes my thumb wiggle, but where is the soul? So nobody's really found that yet. And but we believe it's there, right? So we have to make all of these things better when we treat a patient, right? There, in my case, the brain and their mind and their soul. So, okay, so you go to school and I presume you do some clinical. Do they take you to the hospital?
I don't remember doing that as part of the school curriculum, but we do the practical element is what's called clinical pastoral education. We call it CPE for short, and this is a national body that works with people of all faith traditions. It's not, certainly not Jewish specific. And the CPE sites can be, they can be a variety of different locations. There are CPE sites that are in prisons or hospice facilities or community centers. Even some houses of worship might have their own program, but most CPE sites are associated with hospitals. So in my rabbinical school, it was strongly encouraged. I looked it up before we got on Skype here, and it's now appears to be required, but it was always just one little bit below required when I was there, to do at least one unit of CPE. And that's 400 hours, which is a mix between clinical hours, where you're literally working with patients and doing rounds and doing spiritual care, with didactic sessions taught by the supervisor. And we also go through verbatims, which is the process of reviewing our interactions, where we will present a case study of an interaction we had with a patient in a very detailed and lengthy format. And then everyone in the group will pick it apart about or ask questions of, I noticed you said this or you didn't say that. Did you consider doing this? As a way of really helping us hone our skills. And finally, there is a therapeutic element in the sense that you're required to meet with your supervisor and do your own spiritual check-in on a regular basis of how this work is affecting you and what is being triggered from this experience for you personally. So most of us in my generation and for a few generations before have had this training, and that is probably the most effective way to know how to do this work is literally to do it. It's one thing to sit in a classroom, but to spend 400 hours interacting with patients in a hospital setting really prepares you in a way that reading or talking in a classroom can't.
I wonder, for example, in my teaching, I have residents that trail behind me, kind of an apprenticeship. Do you ever do that? Do you ever work with go in with a senior guy or a woman and you sit and you listen and kind of see how the expert does it? Is that part of it, or are you just on your own?
That's a very small part of it, and I think that's by design with the CPE model, that they're careful not to, let me back up, that going into the room of someone who may have a terminal diagnosis, let's say, or someone who is facing imminent death, is if you've never been in a place like that before, it's intimidating. So and it's natural to say, well, I don't know what I'm supposed to do or say. But if you start following people in, then you're likely to just latch on to what they're doing. Mm. And that's okay in the sense that it will probably help you somewhat, but the goal of CPE is really to strengthen the individual chaplain to be able to feel comfortable in that room being their authentic self, as opposed to modeling what they have seen done by someone else.
Right. So start, I think this is an easy question. So how do you know who to visit?
Every place is different. So I can only really, I've done one unit of CPE. I did it at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles. So I can share a little bit about my experience with that caveat that.
Well, I'm curious, for example, the chaplains in my hospital, they're kind of roaming around. How do they know which room, which door to knock on?
So I can speculate, but one thing is in intake forms, when people are admitted to hospitals, most hospitals at least will have a place for religious preference and maybe some way of asking, would you like would you be interested in a clergy visit? Yes or no. So we get that clergy offices or spiritual care offices will get that information and may do that accordingly. They're different. Each place is different. When I was at Cedars-Sinai, part of my job, I was stationed at the cancer center, was to literally go around and to introduce myself to patients, the kind of cold call in that sense. Introduce myself, say who I am, and ask how their day is going and see if we start a conversation, if they're interested in talking. So you may be seeing chaplains that are literally doing that, just checking in on rooms, knocking, saying, hi, I'm the chaplain, just wanted to see how you are, and starting conversations.
And
people know that they need or want spiritual care, and that's part of our job.
So I presume you're not on commission, right? So that it's like you get paid for the day and or the year, and you're on salary at wherever you are, and this is just part of the job, whether you see 100 people or two. It's kind of just out there. You just do what you need to do. What you try and assess the need. You have to assess the need, right? You could come home at the, probably it must be so independent. You could come home at the end of the day and say, wife, nobody wanted to talk to me today, or everybody wanted to talk to me today. I ran out of time. Probably that has a lot more to do with you than with them, right? How you kind of set it up, when you walk in the room. But I'm also curious, when you walk in the room, people are so diverse in their religious beliefs. I mean, you're a Jewish rabbi. So, but even with the spectrum of Jews, right? You have those who are quite observant and Orthodox, and then, all the way to, I was born Jewish, but I don't really remember much about it. So there's this whole spectrum in between. And then people are sick, where in my experience, it tends to bring out the worst in them. But it also tends to bring out those essential sort of concerns, one of which may be life after death, or at least, kind of hopes thereof, or sort of returning to their sort of what really is important to them that they may have ignored. Do you ever run into stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll throw one more curveball at you. It's not only that I would interact with Jewish patients of different denominations, but at Cedars-Sinai, I would interact with patients of all religious faiths and no religious faith. And that is how the chaplain system is designed at Cedars, where chaplains serve people of all faiths. So it's not just that, the priest visits the Catholic patients, but the priest will visit all the patients on that floor and provide spiritual care. And this is usually when people's heads start to spin and say, well, why would a Jewish person want to talk to a priest? And the answer is that as a chaplain, your job is not just to be your individual religious representative, but to provide what we call spiritual care. And the idea there is that maybe not even everyone has a religion, but everyone has a spirit. Everyone has something inside of them beyond their physical body that they want to express and need support with during these times. Someone who considers themselves atheist or non-religious can still be upset at the prospect of their pending death, probably is, and would like to talk to someone. So our job in that setting is not to try to give them an answer of faith or talk to them about our own faith, but to allow them to talk and talk through what is on their mind in a way that's non-judgmental and oftentimes non-religious. Despite being a rabbi, most of my work is what I would call not religious. Most of my work, despite how this interview is going with me talking a lot, most of my work is being quiet. And that's probably what most chaplains spend their time doing, is asking a question and allowing what we call a non-anxious presence, allowing the patient to be able to speak and to share what they're going through. And in many cases, we're the only person where they're able to do that with.
Okay. Rabbi, welcome back. I think we had some technical difficulties. And you were just talking about how many of the people that you see, not necessarily Jewish, and that you're someone who they can talk to, who maybe in their whole world, they don't have someone they can really bear their soul to. Now, I wanted to ask also, are communications with the hospital chaplain, you know, privileged, like the way, say, with your attorney? In other words, you're bound to secrecy, is that right?
Yes, we fall under HIPAA if we are hospital employees, which most full-time chaplains are. So in that sense, they have access to the patient medical records, which frankly they need to be able to provide spiritual care. And they also chart their interactions on the medical records. So they are shareable with other members of the care team, but certainly are privileged beyond that, beyond those who have access to.
If I tell you something personal on my deathbed, I can rest assured it's going to stay with you.
Yes.
Okay. It's just for the future, you know, so I know.
Yes. And we do take confidentiality extremely seriously, both from a legal and an ethical or moral component. So, and I'm trying to remember back to charting where when I would put chart notes and how I was trained was, you know, is this information that is relevant and necessary for the rest of the care team to know? And if it's not, then it doesn't need to go in. Or, you know, in the case that you described, if it's truly an end of life situation, you know, I'll log that spiritual care was provided, but the details, those don't really need to be shared. So provided spiritual support, period.
All right, so now I have a hard question. You know, as a physician, I go into the room, I assess the patient, do an examination, look at the laboratories, probably prescribe something. And I feel if it's treatable, I know I did a good job if the patient gets better. Now, when you go in to assess a patient and you talk and you listen, how do you know, how do you measure your success? How do you know if you accomplished anything?
That's a great question. That's true of a lot of rabbinic work and spiritual work or therapeutic work, I would say. That how do you know if you're actually doing anything? I was thinking that the hospital visits is probably one of the few components of my job where at least I do feel I have some quantitative measurement of success, you know, compared to teaching a class where, you know, if people come back to the class the next week, okay, it was probably not terrible, but was I effective? Did I teach? You know, these questions that you have to wonder about. But with a hospital visit, the most important thing is that you show up, that you are there. It's your presence. That's probably the most significant thing you will do, far beyond what you will say. So from a community rabbi, someone who works in the synagogue and not in a hospital, when I do my rotations for our congregants in the hospital, I know when I leave the hospital, okay, I visited 4 or 5 patients. I talked to them. I interacted with them. They received a visitor. That is a success. I know that that may seem like a low bar, but I want to emphasize that simply being there and making the visit is a hugely significant act. You know, I should share some of the Jewish background on this, that the mitzvah or the commandment, it's called Bikur Cholim, which means to visit the sick. This has been an instruction that we've had for millennia in the Jewish tradition. And the rabbis and Midrash, which is a rabbinic compendium, as well as numerous places in the Talmud, they say, they have this line that visiting the sick, doing this act, removes 1/60th of the disease. So if I visit someone who is sick, I have lessened their disease by 1/60th. And if that sounds bizarre, I realize it kind of is, but the rabbis use this fraction 1/60th. It wasn't meant literally, like, well, if I go for 60 days, then they'll cure. That's not what they meant. What they meant is that it has an impact. It may be small, but you are doing something.
Yeah, I like that number. It's big enough that it counts, but obviously, you know, it's not like the laying on of hands and they're going to walk out cured. You can't expect miracles, but it's measurable. And it's more than 1%. And in fact, they pick something that's kind of hard to, you know, it's even hard to write down 1/60th. You know, it's kind of, there must have been some, there's probably books written on why that number, but I appreciate that. Well, there's one other topic I think we have to address. And, you know, we're doing this virtual meeting, which we set up, I guess, about 6 weeks or 2 months ago. And I like to do these, but it turns out that that's what everybody's doing today because of the coronavirus. As a rabbi, do you have any special sort of role in this coronavirus pandemic?
Right now, as I and our clergy team, our list of patients, if you will, has increased dramatically to our congregation, not because people are sick, but because we are all at this moment worried about our health and illnesses and our responsibility in spreading or containing, flattening the curve, all of this talk that's going on, that this has become the world of everyone, I think, right now, is these issues. I feel like, yeah, people, clergy members, rabbis, pastors, imams, we're providing a tremendous amount of spiritual care right now to our entire congregation. And that means, you know, in some sense, assurances that we're trying to support our congregants in need, but also comes back to that idea of the non-spiritual presence, that it feels a little bit every time you look at the news that the world is coming crashing down in all sorts of different ways. And
yeah, I think people need support. And then I wonder also, you know, this seems to be a crisis of biblical proportion, right? It's worldwide, hundreds of thousands of people, deaths. Are there people who see this as a plague or a sign, or is this being sort of taken under the wing by zealots as a sign? Have you heard any of that?
I assume that there are always people that will blame any kind of natural disaster or health issue on, you know, God's wrath. That's not really the Jewish approach.
Okay, that's important.
Yeah, and it goes back to, there's always been this question of the interaction between theology and medicine, that if you believe that there is this all-powerful God who is interacting in the world, then if someone gets sick, you might believe, well, God has done that, either because that person did something wrong, and this is a punishment, or because it fits into God's plan somehow that this person needs to be, you know, sick for right now, and we don't know how God's working. And there's still people who take that approach today. I'm very grateful that Judaism went a different way, where we have some verses in the Torah that say, and the Jewish priests, they shall surely heal the people who are ill. And the rabbis latched onto this from a very early age and said, no, you know, whatever illness is, and clearly they didn't understand germ theory or, you know, these concepts that we have today, but they said, no, it's our responsibility. If people are sick, then we're not going against God by trying to heal them. But that's our obligation. It's our moral obligation that we have the tools and the ability to heal people, and we have to do it. We never should ask ourselves, you know, leave this up to God. So that has been a part of Judaism for millennia, which means when we get to issues like this and people said, oh, God wants this, that's, I'm sure there are Jews who might believe that, but in general, that's really an alien idea to the Jewish view of how the world works, and particularly our role in medicine.
So rabbis see themselves as really part of the therapeutic team, focusing on the spiritual needs of that individual, whatever they may be. And it's your job to figure out what those spiritual needs are by, you know, listening to that person and then doing your best to address those needs within your scholarly and training background in terms of human relations. Is that kind of a rough summary?
You summed it up. That's perfect.
Well, Rabbi, I want to thank you for speaking with me today. I would like to speak with you for hours, but my Zoom platform only lets us go for 30 minutes. So we're going to have to cut it short, but I hope we will do this again. And maybe when this coronavirus thing is all done, you know, we could talk about what you did, you know, during those days, you know, the days of the plague. And how that you know changed the congregation, and you know what the rabbis learned through that process, because we like to think that all of these challenges that we face are somehow going to be learning experiences, right? That's that part of the deal.
God willing, I suspect we'll all have our stories about what we did during this time once this passes. And last thing, it's a famous Jewish saying that Gamze Ya'avor, this too shall pass. And it's the kind of the Jewish ethos of looking at the world, whether things are good or not so good, you should still always tell yourself, this won't last forever, whatever it is, that don't take for granted. Also, don't give up hope. God willing, we will get through this and we will get through this stronger, but this virus won't be here forever.
Well, Rabbi Jeremy, thank you very much.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Thank you, Doctor.